Let's open our Bibles now to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Some people, and you've met them, are idealists in life. They look at life through rose-colored glasses. It's essentially a world of make-believe. There was a guy that was having a bad time in his golf game. I mean, it just went from bad to worse, and he couldn't get it back straight. So he went to see a counselor, a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist gave him this counsel, that he should go out and relax by playing a round of golf without a ball. The guy said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, go out and do everything you normally do, but use an imaginary ball." So the next day, the guy went out and did it. He went to the first tee and got his clubs, no ball. And he just swung and imagined a perfect 260-yard drive. Made his second shot a great approach shot, and he putted for par. Well, he played a great round of golf that way. It was all imaginary. Till he got to the 18th hole, and he met a man who was doing exactly the same thing, playing without a ball. Well, they got to talking and found out that they were seeing the same shrink. And so the one guy said, "Tell you what, why don't we play this last hole together?" And they even put $20 bet on the outcome of that last hole. So the first guy gets up and swings, and he announces a 280-yard drive. Perfect, he said. Look at it, right in the middle of the fairway. The second golfer gets up and swings and announces an even match. Said, "Look at it, I hit 280 yards just like you did." So they walk down the fairway, get to their shot, and first guy takes out a 7-iron, and he gets a nice full swing. And he stops and he looks and says, "Now look, did you see that? It went right over the pin and the backspin put it right in the hole. I win," he said. And the second guy said, "No, you don't. You just shot my ball." You'll play better golf that way. There's some people that live like that. They're swinging, but there's no ball. They're not even in the game. It's an idealistic view of life. Make believe. Other people aren't idealists. They're pessimists. Life is cynical because they're cynical. Everything's negative. They're pessimistic in their outlook in life. They're the kind that go into the donut shop and only see the donut holes, not the donuts. The way they figure the Bible is that God took 6 days creating the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he was laid off. That's a pessimist. The way I figure it from reading about Solomon, not only about him, but his writings, is that he began life as an idealist. He started out with a very rosy view of what life was supposed to be like. But as he researched it, as he lived a while, he became a pessimist. And that's pretty evident in his writings, isn't it? Vanity, vanity, everything is vanity, he said. He was pessimistic. I think pretty much most of us start out life as idealists. We have a dream, what life's going to be like, the house with a picket fence, the little dream that goes on in our head. Then we live life, and life beats us up a little bit. And we become pessimistic. However, some people get shipwrecked on that island of pessimism. That's where they end up. They never move beyond that. They never come to a place of balance. A realistic, optimistic, yes, but a realistic view of life. There was a man who died, and his wife decided she needed to call the newspaper to place an obituary. So she called the newspaper and said, "I want you to print these words. Bernie is dead." That's it. And the guy said from the newspaper, "Well, you know, ma'am, you get 6 words for $25. That's how it works. So you have 3 more words. She said, "Okay, put Bernie is dead, Toyota for sale." Pretty realistic view of life. Charles Colson said, "Life is not like a book. Life isn't logical or sensible or orderly. No, life is a mess most of the time. And our theology must be lived out in the midst of that mess. Have you ever heard the expression, "Now I've seen it all"? That's what Solomon begins this paragraph with, that thought. I have seen everything in my days of vanity. I've seen it all, man. I've seen all of the roads that people walk down to find fulfillment. I've observed the sacred person as well as the secular person. I have seen all of the contradictions that life has to offer. And I'm willing to face that with a realistic view. That's what this section is about. In verse 15, Solomon begins facing it head on, a perplexing situation. He says, I've seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. In other words, I've noticed something in life. It's inconsistent, it's wrong, but I've noticed it. Sometimes good people die young, and sometimes really bad people live a long time and prosper. Who hasn't been bothered by that? Every philosopher, every theologian, every thinking person wonders about that one. It sounds very familiar. In fact, it sounds a lot like Psalm 73, where Asaph writing says, God, I know you're good. However, my feet almost stumbled. I almost gave way because I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. It really bugs me to see this seeming contradiction in life where good people get the shaft and sometimes the worst people seem to prosper. We've all dealt with that. The issue is called theodicy. And theodicy is the study of how can you have a good, loving, all-powerful God and an evil world? How do you reconcile those two? Everybody wonders about that. The Gallup organization polled a target group some years ago. And the Gallup poll asked, if you could have a private audience with God Almighty, what's the one question you'd ask Him? Number one answer, why is there suffering in the world? The third one was, why does evil exist? And one of the questions is, when is it all going to stop? Now, in trying to deal with that perplexing situation, people have tried to solve it a number of different ways. Some people choose the way of atheism. There is evil, and so a good, loving God is incompatible with the existence of evil. Thus, there is no God. Period. End of discussion. The late Bertrand Russell, British philosopher, said, I can find no compelling reason to believe in the existence of God because there is evil in the world. And he said, man, quote, man is simply an accident in a backwater. So evil is an accident as a result of the accident called man. Now, that doesn't really handle the problem of evil, because if there is no God, then you have no ultimate value, no ultimate good, no ultimate evil. Everything's relative. It's a sliding scale. It's pure existentialism. And so if you dismiss God, then everything is relative. Moral values, family values, every value is relative to whatever you feel. It doesn't really help or solve the issue. A second answer to that perplexing problem of evil isn't atheism, but agnosticism. Now, an agnostic simply means, I don't know. God may exist, but I don't know if He does. I can't know. Hence the word agnostic. It's a Greek word. A is the Greek prefix for without. And then gnosko, knowledge. I'm without knowledge. I don't know. And it's interesting how people will often use that as their calling card, almost arrogantly. What do you believe in? I'm an agnostic. Ooh. It's interesting that the Latin equivalent of the Greek agnosko is ignoramus. Seriously. But I've yet to find someone say, I'm an ignoramus. It simply means I don't know, but a true agnostic, by the way, is commendable. A true agnostic will look for evidence to see if God does exist or not. It won't just rest in the fact that I don't know, but will attempt to know. Because everything must depend upon that. My confidence in living now and eternity depends on that. So if God does exist, I ought to try to find out. That'd be a true agnostic. However, agnosticism often, more often than not, leads to self-indulgence. You know, the idea is, there is evil in the world, and I don't know if there's a God or not, so I'm just going to make sure I have as much pleasure as I can from now till the day I die. That's usually where it ends up. And eventually, that ends up in pessimism, fatalism. There's another approach to this problem of evil. It's called deism. D-E-I-S-M. Deism. Deism reduces God to a cause only. He's the great clockmaker who wound up the universe, then stepped back and sort of watches it go crazy. The whole God is dead theology that came out a few years ago sprang from deism. God was once around. He sort of started this whole thing, but now it's helplessly out of control. Such is the idea of Rabbi Harold Kushner, who is a deist. Rabbi Harold Kushner wrote several books, probably the best known being When Good Things Happen to Bad People. And he said in his book, quote, God would like people to get what they deserve in life, but he can't always arrange it. There are just some things God doesn't control. And he encourages us, the reader, to please forgive God for his inadequacy. Poor God, you know, he'd love to do something about this mess, but he can't. That's deism. A fourth approach to this problem of evil isn't atheism or agnosticism nor deism, but what I call spiritual idealism. Spiritual idealism is a theology that says evil does exist, but if you're a true Christian, you don't have to ever face it. You never have to be sick, and if you live by faith, above it all, you can drive a Ferrari instead of a Volkswagen, and everybody else may be sick, but you'll be in perfect health till the day you die. Question is, what do you die of? I don't know. This is Christianity without any unpleasant aftertaste. It is simply an oversimplification of a very complex issue. The problem of evil is complex. To put a Band-Aid on it like that doesn't help anybody. It's an oversimplification. That was the thinking, by the way, of Job's three friends. Job was suffering. Job lost it all. And Job was the godliest guy alive. And so his three friends approached him and had these dialogues, and the long and short of it is, well, we thought you were pretty godly, but the fact that you're suffering so much proves that you really must be a creep. You must be a bad, bad sinner. Because if you were good, this would never happen to you. Because good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. It was an oversimplification of a complex issue. In the modern circles where this spiritual idealism travels, what you are told is that you can escape evil by your confession of your mouth. Don't make a negative confession, make a positive confession. Claim this, claim that. Don't make a negative confession. And so, if you say something like, well, you know, I'm feeling kind of sick today. Don't say that. Now you're going to get sick because you've sowed the seed. It's going to happen now. I even remember a person who died, and after his death, somebody had the audacity to say afterwards, well, you know, I did hear him say a couple, you know, weeks ago, well, I could just die. So what happens if you say, well, I'll be a monkey's uncle? The best approach, the fifth approach, is biblical realism. Face it in reality, a realistic view, biblical realism. Biblical realism says evil is real, God is real, and there are many reasons for the existence of evil in this world. I'll give you a smattering of reasons. Number one, the presence of an evil super being called Satan. This account takes that into consideration. Satan rebelled against God, and we are still feeling the aftershocks of that generations later. Another reason evil exists is because of man's foolishness. you have over in the Middle East dictators who oppress their own people. You have in India an interesting situation. You've got a country that's one of the most fertile countries on earth, yet people are starving. Why? Because they've embraced a belief system that deifies the rat, the monkey, the cow. Those are their gods. And so those gods eat all the foodstuffs at the expense of people. Another reason evil exists is because God has given us freedom of choice. And whenever you give anybody freedom of choice, you run a risk making the wrong choice. You can embrace people, you can kill them. You can obey God, you can disobey God. Another reason evil exists is when people try to defy natural law that God has put in this world for our benefit. Gravity is a natural law. It's here for our benefit. It's why you're sitting here, not flying around. You have gravity. Now, if you try to defy the law of gravity, don't blame God for it. If you decide you're going to jump off of a building because you'd like to bounce, I'm sorry, you won't bounce. In certain parts of our world, there are courses for hurricanes that develop. Hurricanes release pent-up energy in the Earth's atmosphere. They're necessary. There are places where the tectonic plates of the earth shift and there are fault lines. Well, if you build your house on a fault line or in a path of a hurricane, and you can sit there all day and say, I bind every hurricane, but it won't work. Now, let's look at a promising solution in the midst of that. Beginning now in verse 16, he gives some wisdom. And the question is, given the fact that we live in a mess, as Colson said, most of the time, that's how life is lived, how do we work out our theology in the midst of that? Solomon would say, number one, avoid imbalance. Verse 16, do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? Now, that is often misinterpreted as Solomon saying, walk the middle of the road. Don't be too sinful, but don't be overboard in spirituality. You know, pray, but you don't have to pray every day. Read your Bible, but, you know, don't take it too seriously. Come to church, but then skip 6 months and come again. You know, don't go overboard. That's not what it's saying. In verse 16, the verbs that are used are reflexive verbs in the Hebrew language. And it would be best translated as saying, don't claim to be righteous yourself. Don't claim to be wise yourself. This is a warning against self-righteousness and pride. Listen to that verse in the Amplified Version. Be not morbidly exacting and externally righteous overmuch. Neither strive to make yourself pretentiously appear overwise. Why should you get puffed up and destroy yourself with presumptuous self-sufficiency? So the bottom line here is this. Love God intensely, but don't check out of reality. Love God intensely, but don't leave reality. Do you remember the New Testament Pharisees, how they handled the problem of evil? They ignored it. They hid from it, basically. There was a street where the Gentiles occupied. There was sinful acts going on. They would cover their eyes. They pull their robes close to them. And they would walk through the street, heads down. They still do it today as they go from one place in Jerusalem through the Arab quarter. And just hide yourself from the evil. Don't touch any of the cooties that you could get from the unbelieving world. And we'll cloister ourselves away and deny it or hide from it. And by the way, who has not been tempted as Christians to do the same thing? How often we've looked at this unbelieving pagan world and we've thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a Christian village somewhere where every neighbor is a Christian neighbor, every store is a Christian store filled with Christian people, Christian banks, Christian police officers, Christian mayor? You've just described heaven, friend. Jesus Christ insisted that you and I live out our Christianity next to the blasphemer, next to the filthy mouth, next to the God-hater, so that we could be light and salt in this world. Don't hide from it. Avoid imbalance. You know, I've heard people say, well, if I could only work around Christians, man, that'd be the greatest. Take it from someone who does, it's not all that great. I mean, we all love each other. But sometimes you come into those situations with higher expectations and you realize, you know what? They're humans, aren't they? Then Solomon would say, as a solution, apply wisdom, godly wisdom. Verse 18, it is good that you grasp this and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. Not self-righteousness, not self-indulgence. The idea here is self-restraint due to wisdom. Self-restraint due to wisdom. Notice that Solomon mentions the one who fears God. That's a common term that Solomon loved to use. Put God first. Fear the Lord. Respect and honor Him. Know that God sees everything that you do. That will give you wisdom. And that kind of wisdom will strengthen you to handle the tensions of life's unanswered questions. See, wisdom looks at evil, notices it, sees it, believes in a loving, real God, feels the tension of that, but rests in the fact that God will one day bring a judgment and will right every wrong and bring in righteousness when He brings the judgment. But by the way, when we talk about wicked people prospering, and we say, why is that? How come the good people don't, but the wicked people seem to prosper? You would only say that if you're thinking short term. Lift your eyes a little higher on the horizon and think long term, in the long run, in the eternal long run, how good off, how well off are the unrighteous? Good? No. I mentioned Psalm 73 a moment ago. Asaph said, my feet almost slipped when I was envious of the boastful, seeing the prosperity of the wicked. At the end of that psalm, he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God and I understood where they're going to end up. And I wasn't envious of them anymore. You see, the issue isn't where you are today. It's where will you be forever and forever. Jesus said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses what? His own soul. That's the idea. They may look like they're on easy street, but what's the end of the road like? Oh, but they have it so good. Yeah, it's sort of like they're lounging on the deck of the Titanic. Whoopee. Go down to verse 20, and it's the third section of this. It's a pervasive condition that Solomon notices, and he, beginning in verse 20 to the very end, this is what he takes the bulk of his space saying. And this is a key that unlocks part of the problem of evil. Look at verse 20. For there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. Verse 29. Truly, this only have I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. See, the problem of evil is really a problem of the evil nature within men. Mankind, every man, woman, child, is infected with a virus, worse than HIV because it's eternal. It's the SIN virus. We've all been infected with it. Isaiah said, all of us like sheep have gone astray. We've all sought our own way. Paul said in Romans, there's none that does good, no, not one. We've all sinned and we've all fallen short of the glory of God. That's the problem. Psychologists may blame a behavioral disorder. Sociologists may call it a cultural lag. A minority group may say the real problem is racism. No, it's not. The real problem is the sin nature of man. It's called depravity. And the only cure is the blood of Christ on the cross of Calvary. That's God's solution to the sin infection, the virus. There's only one antidote, the blood of Christ. And that's why we celebrate Christmas and Easter, that God invaded earth with a man called Jesus, God in human flesh, to pay the penalty to take away our sins. Now, Solomon states that as the condition of mankind, part of the problem. We're all sinners. There's not a man who does right and doesn't sin. And he would say in verse 21, remember that when you listen to people. He says, do not take to heart everything that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. You're the boss, you walk by your employee's desk and you overhear one talking to the other. Isn't that boss a jerk? Ooh. If you want to be aware of the sinful nature of humanity, just listen to people talk. Go to a movie, turn on television, listen to what they say. Listen to people talk as they drive. It's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was turning on Osuna the other day, making a right turn, coming up here from down the street. And I think I was third, maybe even fourth in a line. I was following a line of cars making the same right turn. So I had to wait my turn. Stop sign, you look both ways, you turn right. There was a guy behind me honking and yelling. I mean, we didn't have the right to be on that road. How dare us be at that stop sign when he wanted to be there? So he honked. We couldn't move, but he decided to go around us to the right and go up on the curb and pass all of us up and then take a right turn. And I noticed his car. It was all beat up. And as he went, he was yelling, and he put his arm out the window, gave us a very interesting gesture. And rather than taking it personally, which, you know, in my flesh, I'd love to just go hunt him down all over the state, wherever he goes, I just thought, you know, there it is again. It's a reminder of the sinful nature that we all have. Charles Spurgeon wrote in Lectures to My Students, it's a training guide for young ministers. He said, the minister ought to have one blind eye and one deaf ear. You cannot stop people's tongues, and therefore the best thing to do is to stop your own ears and never mind what is spoken. Good counsel for all of us. So this pervasive condition, the depravity of humanity, remember that when you listen. He would also say, remember that when you speak. For he says in the next verse, for many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. How dare they say that about me? Have you ever said anything about anyone else? No, liar. You know you have. And you can't expect others to be perfect. You're not perfect yourself. I've always been interested that Paul, after 30 years of walking with Christ in Romans chapter 7, says, oh, wretched man that I am. Paul, you? You know, most of us would say, oh, wretched man that you are. Oh, wretched driver that he was. Now, oh, wretched man that I am. You don't have to look very far to find evil. Just look in the mirror. You'll see it within yourself. That's what he's saying here. The Minnesota Crime Commission put out something a few years back that helps us understand evil. I think it's a very realistic view of life. The Minnesota Crime Commission said, quote, every baby starts life as a little savage. He is completely selfish and self-centered. He wants what he wants when he wants it, whether it's his bottle, his mother's attention, his playmate's toy, his uncle's watch. Deny any of these, and he seethes with rage and aggressiveness, which would be murderous were he not so helpless. If permitted to continue in the self-centered world of his infancy, given free rein to his impulsive actions to satisfy his wants, every child would grow up a criminal, a thief, a killer, a rapist. Solomon would continue that thought and say, remember that whenever you study and you think you know it all. Verse 23, all of this I have proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. As for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? I applied my heart to know, to search, and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know wickedness and folly, even of foolishness and madness. Good verse 27. Here's what I have found, says the preacher. Adding one thing to the other to find out the reason, which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. You know, Solomon had a goal. We already know what that is. That's the whole idea of this book of Ecclesiastes. The goal was to plumb the depths of human experience and find out the meaning of life. He wanted to solve the mysteries, man. He wanted to untangle all the messes through his wisdom. Here, however, he finally, honestly admits, even me, with all the wisdom God has given me, I can't understand it. I have a limitation in my own knowledge. I wanted to be an expert in this stuff. I don't know why. I'm at an end. A limitation of human knowledge. Wisdom doesn't come from observation or investigation. This kind of wisdom can only come from special revelation. And without special revelation, life is an insoluble puzzle. There was a time, maybe for some it still is, but there was a time when you were so smart. You knew everything. It's called youth. I remember the days when I knew absolutely the answer for every issue. Ask me any deep theological, I'll tell you the reason. And even before I was saved, you know, I was much smarter than my parents. And there was a time in my life I just realized, why are my parents so dumb? They can't get this. This is so simple. All I have to do is ask me. I'll enlighten them. And then I grew up. And the older I grow, the dumber I get. I realize I don't know it all. Thomas Edison, the great inventor, was right. We don't know 1/1,000,000th of 1% of anything. Paul the Apostle wrote to the Corinthians in chapter 8, verse 2, if anyone thinks he knows anything, he knows nothing as he ought to know. It's a great day when you realize you don't know it all. But a great manifestation of the sinful nature of man is the know-it-all. And then Solomon would say, remember this in your relationships. Verse 26. I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God shall escape her, but the sinner shall be trapped by her. Here's what I have found, says the preacher, adding one thing to the other to find out the reason which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. One man among 1,000 I have found, but a woman among all these I have not found. Truly this only I have found. Truly God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. You read that and you're tempted to say, boy, is this guy down on women or what? But in verse 26, first of all, he's speaking about a prostitute, a woman who would ensnare a man. And Solomon had his fill of those. Keep in mind that Solomon, in bringing a lot of people around him, would be surrounded by people, even gals, who sought his attention with an ulterior motive. And some of them were prostitutes. And Solomon loved many foreign women, the Bible says, and they ensnared his heart and he turned away from God. And every time he found a new woman, by the way, he had 700 wives and 300 other courtesans, he was trying to find fulfillment in life by a sexual encounter. He thought, oh, look at her. She's gorgeous. She's the one. I've missed it all along. This is my 288th time. I'm going to try her. Only to find that his emptiness was still there. He didn't find it there. When Josh McDowell was touring the country one time, speaking at universities on love and sexuality and intimacy, he said a woman called his room after a lecture one evening and said, Mr. McDowell, in the last 5 nights, I've gone to bed with 5 different men. Tonight, I got out of bed and I asked myself, is that all there is? As she began to weep, she finally said, please tell me there's something more. Those kind of sexual encounters don't solve the emptiness problem. They compound the problem. Here's what Solomon is saying in all of these verses. He's expressing a disappointment with human relationships in general, whether it's the prostitute, the women that he once went after, or it was confidants, friends. He said, you can find 1 faithful out of 1,000, period. He's expressing disillusionment with people. You see, this is how it worked. Solomon would see somebody and be impressed. There's a cool guy. I need to get to know that person. I want to be friends with that person. And so he became friends with that person, became very disillusioned as he found out that person didn't meet my expectations. That person isn't perfect. Duh. Here is the problem with being a perfectionist. If any of you are perfectionists, let me first say, God bless you. And then let me say, God help you. And finally, God help anyone who lives with you. Because you want everyone and everything to be perfect, but you live in an imperfect, fallen world. So you're going to be constantly frustrated and frustrate everyone else in your path. As somebody once said, a perfectionist is simply somebody who takes great pains and gives them to somebody else. So Solomon would say, remember, all men are sinners in these four areas. So, we live in a sinful world. You can do a few things with that. You can hide from it. You can deny it. You can idealize it. You can apply shoddy theology to it. Or you can face it and realize you're part of the problem. You're part of the problem. All people are sinners. And the solution is to fear God, live a godly life in the balance of wisdom, applying the blood of Christ to our lives. I would sum up this whole realistic view of Solomon by that great poem that I've always loved and used oftentimes that says, life is short, death is sure, sin the cause, Christ the cure.